So, I'll just read out the verses, and then there's a few lines that we'll cover in some detail, but not all of them. The single face of the chief lady is the understanding of all events as a single knowledge. The green colour of her body is power in all faculties. Her two hands are the two truths, her right hand the conventional truth, her left hand the ultimate truth. Her wearing of all ornaments is the completion of the stocks of merit and knowledge. Her right hand in the gift-bestowing gesture is the contemplation of the perfection of charity. Her left hand in the protection gesture is the guarding of all beings from fear and terror. Her right leg stretched out is the abandonment of all defects of Mara. Her left leg drawn back is the understanding of all qualities. Her holding of the lotus blossom is the bringing of joy to all beings. Her being 16 years of age is the ability to accomplish the aims of all beings. Her throne of the orb of the moon is the possession of the perfection of wisdom. Her throne of a vari-coloured lotus is the possession of the essence of compassion. So we got as far as her right leg stretched out is the abandonment of all defects of Mara. Well, if you are going to step into the world to help beings, you need to do it with as pure a motivation as you can muster. In Tara's case, that motivation's pure, isn't it? Because she moves into the world seeing the emptiness of beings. She's not caught up in the arena of self that we've been talking about, where we are. She's not stepping into the world from the arena of self. She moves into the world touched by the emptiness of beings. If we move into the world, we do it from the arena of self and belief in a self. So if we're going to do it then, and certainly we shouldn't think of avoiding that sort of compassionate action just because we are not yet touched by emptiness, of course we should try and practice some sort of compassionate activity when we can, but then we do it with awareness of our limitations and awareness of our biases perhaps, and certainly awareness of our own samskaras, our own patterns and defences, preferences. So interesting, this word, I thought this word, it's abandoned. She's legs stretched out is the abandonment of all defects of Mara. Tara has abandoned self. She's abandoned that belief in self as some inherent, fixed selfness, selfhood. That's what she's abandoned. And hence, abandoned the defects of Mara. I think that's how I look in this line. Because with no trace of ego, or with ego willing, which we've mentioned before, then there would be no handle, I think there'd be no handle for Mara to catch hold of, nothing for him to stick to, nothing for his alluring distractions to stick to. So if you remember the fourth kind of silence that Bhante mentioned, so that was when he was talking about actually four kinds of silence that came from a Christian mystic tradition, which he was explaining in Buddhist terms. There was the silence of the will, and he explained that as being when the ego is not speaking out, when the self is silent. So that might be a way of reflecting on our compassionate capabilities. Can ourself, can myself, yourself be silent? To what extent do I manage to do that? To what extent do I manage for my ego not to speak out And I was thinking, well, the alternative to that seemed to me, at least after being in retreat, the meditation retreat for almost 2 weeks, the alternative to that seemed to be, can I just simply reach out and connect, you know, between the space between me and another. Something very simple, just a kind of reaching out, or her leg stretched out, or her hand stretched out. Can I manage to do that without my ego being involved in it? Very simple. And then having made that movement out, that bridge, that touch, in whatever way, it doesn't need to be an actual touch, but in whatever way we do it, just see what happens. Having that connection felt presence of that kind of movement and connection made, just maybe see what happens. Without my ego being involved in it, without my self speaking. So I was reflecting on something like this in my own case, on the study and reflection retreat which Sadhanandi and I did aeons ago before this. Well, 2 weeks ago, before this retreat started, we were on retreat. So it was a study and reflection retreat, and I found myself reflecting on this kind of area, which arose out of talking about, well, I'd been talking about the obstacles to courage. Now, they were the ones I mentioned at the beginning of this retreat, if you remember that far back. So it arose out of that. So just to remind us, the obstacles to courage are clinging to worldly happiness, samsaric worldly happiness, clinging to ego, clinging to individual liberation, and clinging to pride. And part of clinging to pride was said to be not being willing to receive help, but also not being willing to give help. And on this previous study one, we were puzzling about why it would be clinging to pride, to be not willing to be of help. And a discussion arose, and I began to make a connection with one of my own patterns with a particular person. So in general, of myself, I'd say I genuinely want transparency between myself and other people, and I genuinely want to get to the truth of matters. And in reflecting about this particular pattern, I realised, yes, that's true, and I'm going to give myself credit for it. But I think it's also true that I cling to that in a particular way, and I take pride in it in a particular way. And what I realised on that retreat was, to the extent I take pride in it and cling to it, to the extent that I'm not prepared to make the sort of simple, you know, short-term, interim moves towards someone, the simple "how are you doing" one morning, because I want the complete whole hog, transparent and acknowledgement of events. I want the long-term complete solution. Actually, I mean, kind of fair enough, but not really when actually something else comes in. So much am I wanting that, that somewhere I refuse to make the simple outward movement and make a connection or say, "How are you doing?" I mean, basically, in clinging to my long-term strategy, which will include an acknowledgement of how I've been affected by this person's actions, of course, I'm not prepared to give the helpful, simpler offer of ordinary connection. And I must say, I've been rather sobered by realising that. You know, especially when that short-term, simple move would itself support the possibility of the longer-term, more complete communication actually happening. And I got the point, I thought, well, if Shantideva was here, he'd just look at me and say, "What a pity." And it is, isn't it? What a pity. What a series of missed opportunities. So it seemed very helpful seeing that, and sobering. It's been quite sobering. You know, because actually Mara had managed to turn one of my genuine longings, you know, for truth, for knowing how things are, that's genuine longing, into a sort of snag that got caught up with clinging and to a certain extent with pride. So I found that sort of reflection to be very helpful, and it didn't start off being reflecting on how silent can myself be, but that's where it's led me. So that might be a starting off point for making that kind of further reflection yourselves. Just how silent can our ego be? How silent can our self be? And in that quote, which don't have from Bhante, I don't have it with me actually, but he talks, if you remember, he talks about it being natural, that there's an inner silence and wisdom that's natural. Natural in the sense that it's deep within us, but it's covered over with layers of other habits and other emotional turbulence. And it's that sort of emotional turbulence that become the sort of defects that Mara can snag onto and stick onto. So that's, with Tara having abandoned the view of self and the relying on that kind of inherent selfness, then the snags have gone. The stickiness is gone. The emotional turbulences have gone. So reflect maybe on how silent can one's ego be? Can oneself avoid speaking out? Just at the moment when a simple movement could create a bridge between you and another. So next line, her left leg drawn back is the understanding of all qualities. Her left leg is in meditation posture, in contrast to her right leg, which is stepping down. So it does suggest a more contemplative aspect of Tara. It strikes me that this line, the left leg drawn back, the understanding of all qualities, is the balance it's the balance for the more active moving out, or even the ballast, the counterweight that allows poise and precision in her compassionate activity, appropriateness. I think that's where I came to with this one, that a more meditative, contemplative understanding of all qualities, perhaps that allows poise, precision of response, and appropriateness of response when she is stepping out into the world. And it was one of the qualities of the Buddha, wasn't it? His appropriateness, he responded appropriately. Kisa Gotami comes distraught, carrying a dead son, just seeking help. Someone said, "We can't think how to help you. Ask the Buddha." He responds appropriately, doesn't he? He responds first of all sympathetically, and simply. I mean, he doesn't give her a talk on impermanence. He says, "Find the mustard seed. If you find the mustard seed, I can help." There has to be a mustard seed. I'm sure you all know the story, but it has to be a mustard seed in a house where no one's died. Something so, you know, poised, precise, appropriate, and compassionate in that response. So perhaps with this line, we could reflect on our measure of appropriateness, to what extent we have ability to respond appropriately to situations, or our measure of patience in situations, just being able to take a breath sometimes. Take a bit of time rather than jump too quickly to strategies, which is something I'm rather prone to myself. But just to take time, draw breath, be patient. For the next two lines, her holding of the lotus blossom is the bringing of joy to all beings. Her being 16 years of age is the ability to accomplish the aims of all beings. She just wants happiness for beings, for all beings. No doubt, a bodhisattva on that level wants the real happiness for all beings, the happiness that arises from seeing how things really are. But in the meantime, she's not going to quibble at helping any kind of happiness to arise. And as a 16, the 16-year-old figure, and 16 is the age of maturity in the Indian kind of thinking, at least of that time. So it's a bit like you're mature but young enough to have all the energy that you'd need to have the ability to accomplish the aims of all beings. So this sort of activity and motivation arise, then clearly we're well within the influence of the bodhicitta here. The rising of the thought of enlightenment for the sake of, thought of attaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings, not just for oneself. And then, first of all, that's there as an aspiration, and then there's the first steps of practicing it, and then it's full consummation, as it were, in great emptiness and realization, great compassion and the realization of emptiness arising together. I came across a verse which it's said to be Nagarjuna, again, it's from the Nyingmapa tradition, but they say they're quoting Nagarjuna. The verse is, so when the yogis, when the meditators, have developed this direct apprehension of emptiness in their minds, do not doubt that the altruistic thoughts concerned with others' welfare will arise. So, fairly straightforward statement, emphatic statement there, that emptiness and non-discriminating compassion are realised simultaneously. So you might have to think about that, and there's a fill in a bit between, you fill in the gaps a bit between that, and but if you think about it, the more deeply we could realise emptiness, conditionality, then the more deeply would we understand the possibility of ending suffering. The more deeply would we understand Four Noble Truths. So the more deeply we understand conditionality and emptiness, the more deeply do we see the possibility of ending suffering. And presumably then the more deeply we see that possibility is there for every being. If it's there for one being, it must be there for every being, or else it's there for none. So the more deeply we see that possibility for every being, then the more, therefore, presumably, our compassion will also deepen as we, because then we'd also see, seeing the emptiness, conditionality, the possibility for the ending of suffering more and more deeply, we also see how beings are blind to that priceless possibility. So a few days ago, Vidyamala quoted from Vimalakirti Nirdesha, the quote we've had a few times about, first you seeing the emptiness of beings and then the great love for beings and how it arises, and there's a footnote to that section that she quoted, which was about that compassion isn't just commiseration with people suffering. It's out of the sheer joy of realising the release that comes with being touched by emptiness. There's a sheer joy that comes with that, but at the same time, and there's a seeing the complete possibility of that for all other beings. But there's also looking round and seeing that those other beings, by and large, don't see that possibility themselves. They turn again and again and again and again to the things that don't work, which is, of course, what I said before with Shantideva seeing that response is, what a pity. And at that point, with the dialogue between Vimalakirti and Manjushri, that's where Vimalakirti starts describing this great outpouring of love. And so there's a sense that it comes from seeing what the footnote describes as the kind of gravitational effect of the living beingness that we have which is another way of saying the view of self that we rely on, that the Bodhisattva has the great joy of release themselves, and the surety that that's possible for every being in the universe, but then seeing all the beings who don't see that. And then compassion arises in independence of seeing then how those beings are blind to it. How they keep operating within this arena of self that I've been talking about. So in seeing that possibility for all beings, we are seeing the sameness of beings, aren't we? And and it reminded me of it was some years by now, it's about 6 years ago. I went on a world trip with Padmavati, a friend of mine. Yeah. Our daughters were, my daughter and her youngest daughter were left home, so we went on a world trip. And got back, it was about 7 months, got back. I was on the convention soon after, and our chapter were having supper with Bhante, and I was sitting next to Bhante. So he asked me, or someone else asked me, which bits of the trip had I particularly, you know, kind of liked. And I sort of said, well, Fiji was good. And Bhante said something. Bhante said, the conversation went elsewhere, and then Bhante came back to me and said, what was your impression of all those places? And I thought for a minute and said, well, actually, my main impression, although, of course, there was lots and lots of things that I could sit here and say there was that, it was wonderful, and there was this, and that was hard, and that was difficult. But actually, my main impression was the sameness of people. Just the sameness of people in all sorts of different circumstances. I mean, you know, streets of Chennai, you're sitting on a rickshaw, streets are full of fumes and everything, and right by the edge there's, you know, a woman with a metal can full of water washing her baby in the midst of all this pollution. And then you go to another country, and, you know, there's not that kind of poverty, and there's not that kind of privation in a certain way, well, at all. But there's just a different kind of suffering, you know. And in other places, there's a suffering almost of having too much at your disposal, people's disposal. And I suppose that was just what struck me, that all these different circumstances and people in them in different ways, and some you'd call very fortunate and some you'd call very unfortunate, but there seemed to be there was just a sameness of what it means to be a human being. You know, what it means to live within the human condition, and the kinds of the content that was there. Different guises, but the content seemed to just be the same. So I was very struck by it. And I suppose keeping in touch with that actually is a help to keeping in touch with the possibility of release and enlightenment for all beings, and wanting it to happen for all beings. So we're very nearly at the end of this. These lines written to Tara by Nagarjuna, and probably we're all still sitting here in the arena of self, not having let go of our view of self. It does take a while, so I'm told. So we're still in the arena of self, but we can practice contemplating the suffering of beings. We've been doing it already in this retreat. We can practice contemplating the joys of beings. We can practice tuning into the sameness of beings. And we can practice as if. We can practice as if we were not in the arena of self, but in the arena of non-discriminating compassion. So I'll just read the last two lines. I won't say a word about them. Her throne of the orb of the moon is a possession of the perfection of wisdom. Her throne of a vari-coloured lotus is the possession of the essence of compassion.